This podcast is brought to you by BMJ Best Practice. BMJ Best Practice offers evidence-based, continually updated, and practical knowledge that will help you make better clinical decisions.
Hello and welcome to this BMJ Best Practice podcast on sepsis in adults. Kieran Walsh is my name. I'm Clinical Director at BMJ. Sepsis is common. In 2018, more than 1 million US Medicare patients were admitted to hospital with sepsis. And complications are serious, including renal failure, ARDS, and DIC. So it's important that we get assessment and management of this condition right. To give us more details about the problem and what we can do about it, we have on the line Professor Andre Khalil, Department of Internal Medicine, University of Nebraska Medical Center. And importantly, Andre is author of our BMJ Best Practice topic on sepsis. So Andre, you're welcome. Let's start off by asking, what exactly is sepsis?
Thanks, Kieran, for the invitation. This is really an important, very important topic because we as clinicians do see that frequently, pretty much on a daily basis in my practice as well. Sepsis has had many, many definitions through the years, but the one that I believe that is the most recent, it was called Sepsis 3, was published in 2016. It's still, it sounds like 2016 was so long ago, but still it's pretty much the current definition. I think it's the most reasonable definition because basically it says that it is a dysregulated host response secondary to infection. So basically it's a situation where you have a organ dysfunction that is provoked by this dysregulated immunological response that is secondary to infection. So basically, you know, the definition of sepsis really requires the presence of an infection. This is really important because we're going to talk a little bit later about there are so many mimics and different things that can look like sepsis, smell like sepsis, but it's not sepsis at all. And that's something we can talk a little later. But I think for the time being, it is how we human beings respond to infection and how this infection really sometimes triggers a inflammatory immunological response that end up with organ damage, organ dysfunction, and lead us to need to be hospitalized, sometimes going to the ICU, and requiring a lot of organ support and different treatments. So this is really the biggest way to define sepsis today.
Thank you. How do you make the diagnosis?
So the diagnosis is one of the most difficult parts hearing of sepsis because there are so many different ways that sepsis can present. So generally speaking, the dysregulated host response, the way we respond to this, this kind of really intense infections is defined in two general ways. One is what you call a hyperinflammatory response where, the patient is going to present with fever and, leukocytosis, an elevated white count and feeling terrible, pain and headaches and whatever, short of breath if it's a pneumonia. So a lot of symptoms are going to be very abundant. And this is, usually when you do the blood test, you're going to see this very overt inflammatory response. And that's kind of the usual textbook definition where patients are going to have all these symptoms. Unfortunately, a lot of times, probably, half of the times or more, patients will have sepsis, will have a infection-induced organ dysfunction without all these overt symptoms and signs. A lot of times they will not have too much fever. Sometimes even their blood tests are not going to have too much of things like leukocytosis. And this is what you call the hypoinflammatory, response. So it means it's a situation where the system is really more down than up. And that really can be a little misleading because when we get our training as physicians, we tend to think that if somebody doesn't have a fever or inflammatory reaction, that should not be infection. It's quite the opposite. Half or more of the case will not have this classic signs. And this is really important, especially nowadays, Kieran, because different from 20 years ago, 15 years ago, today, we have a much larger patient population that is already immunocompromised before even they develop sepsis. So that means, you know, they could have had a organ transplant, they could have had a bone marrow transplant, they could have had a chemotherapy for cancer, or they're using biologicals for rheumatological diseases. So a lot of things, a lot of immunosuppressive drugs are being used to treat different conditions. So the patient already has a immunocompromised state before developing sepsis. So this patient actually likely will not develop fever, will not develop elevated white count, will not have a lot of overt inflammatory symptoms, and yet the patient can progress to severe organ dysfunction, life-threatening, and even die from this. So that's why, diagnostic-wise, we have to have a very high suspicion. We have to do a good history. We have to do a good physical examination. It's critical at the bedside to really have very thorough, and we can talk a little further probably, if that's one of your next questions, about potentially diagnostic tests as well.
Yeah, great. Let's move on to exactly that, diagnostic tests. What tests are needed?
So you know, in order to know the best tests, Kieran, you really, we have to go back to the, you know, more traditional approach where your history and your physical examination at bedside will delineate which tests are going to be needed. So this is really important. There is no, you know, there's no cook recipe that says, well, you know, if you do this, you know, test A, B, and C, you're going to get sepsis. It's not going to be like that. So you really have to direct your rationale, your reasoning towards where likely, what type of infection it is. I'll give an example. For instance, if you have somebody coming with, you know, cough and short of breath, you're gonna be thinking about lungs. You're gonna be thinking about lung infection. Think about pneumonia. This is a situation where you're gonna have to potentially have chest X-rays or eventually, you know, a tomography, a CT scan. You're gonna have to look for a sputum that potentially can give you a culture and give you the etiology of the pneumonia. So this is a situation where you're going to order tests related to where the infection is. For instance, if you have somebody coming with a terrible headache and fever and you're suspecting that the sepsis is coming from meningitis, then this is a situation where your best diagnostic test is going to be doing a lumbar puncture, getting the spinal fluid, and looking for bugs that potentially could be causing meningitis. So the diagnostic tests of sepsis will be 100% related to where is potentially located the infection. And that's really how you direct and how you approach the diagnostics. This is really important because otherwise, if you're in the wrong, you know, if you're in the wrong situation, in the wrong pathway, you may end up doing diagnostic tests that are not going to be useful and may delay the diagnosis of the infection.
Andre, thank you. You also mentioned mimics. What else could it be? What else should you think about when making the diagnosis?
So, you know, Kieran, this is something that really it is critical for us at the bedside to look for mimics, because if we're dealing with something that looks like sepsis and it's not sepsis, we may end up missing the diagnosis and delaying the diagnosis of something that needs to be treated. I'll give an example. For instance, patients that have acute pancreatitis, acute inflammation of the pancreas, they can have fever, they can have hypotension, they can have all the signs of organ dysfunction that looks like sepsis. It's an acute pancreatitis that requires a whole different, you know, treatment. I'll give another example. Somebody can have acute heart failure with short of breath from the heart failure, hypotension because the heart's not full, you know, working very well, and sometimes these patients can be diagnosed with sepsis suspected from pneumonia, and it is a situation where the heart's failing, the heart needs, you know, a specific treatment for heart failure. So there are many, many things. So I think the physician at the bedside has to be thinking, okay, I really want to make sure that I'm not missing infection. I want to make sure that I'm approaching sepsis as efficient and as fast as possible, but I don't want to lose the track of things that could be mimicking sepsis that potentially also require a different type of treatment. So because the way we as hosts, we as human beings respond to infection is not very different from the ways that we respond to other, you know, acute stress situations like trauma, pancreatitis. So all these things potentially can mimic sepsis because our body has this immune response that's universal for both infection and non-infection etiologies as well.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear. Let's move on to management. What's the mainstay of management?
So today, 2024, Kieran, there is absolutely nothing that is more important to save lives than the precise and the rapid initiation of antibiotics. There's so much data, so much evidence for this. And some of this evidence, we participated in some studies in the past as well. So basically, you know, for every hour that you delay the initiation of appropriate antibiotics, the mortality of these patients increased by something in the range of 5 to 10%. It's really high. And the reason why is because, you know, the longer the delay of antibiotic initiation, the bigger the replication of the bacteria or the infectious cause, and the burden of the infection, you know, start to get bigger and bigger and bigger, to a point where if your delay is too long, there will be no way back, because the burden of the infection is going to be too much. The dysregulation of the organs are going to be too intense, and potentially this patient can die because of this multi-organ failure secondary to an infection. So critical, when you have a suspicion of sepsis by the clinical symptoms, by the physical examination, it is, once you identify the potential source of sepsis, where is the infection located, you can have a better approach about which antibiotics are going to be the most appropriate. And that's the first part. The second part is when you order antibiotics in your hospital. And this is really important, Kieran, because depends on where you are in the planet, things can be a little bit different because of the resources of your hospital. When you put the order, say, you know, that's the antibiotic that the patient needs at this point to treat sepsis, that has to be prioritized with the nursing staff, with the pharmacy staff. Everyone has to, you know, somebody has to get the order, has to dilute the drug, has to bring the drug from the pharmacy, bring to the pharmacy, to the nurse bring to the bedside. All these things are, you know, going to take time. So it's not enough to just say, okay, I'm the physician, I put the order here for antibiotics, and this is going to get done. Now, your job is actually pass the message to the nursing staff, to the pharmacy staff. This has to be prioritized over everything else, because if you don't kill the bugs, the infection will continue. If the infection continues, the host dysregulation response is going to continue, and potentially the organ's function is going to get even worse. So time is absolutely of essence. There is nothing up to this day that proved to be better to treat sepsis than the appropriate use and the timely use of antibiotics.
Okay, thank you. Besides delayed administration of antibiotics, what would you say are the other common pitfalls in management?
So the other common pitfalls in the management is, I would say maybe there are a few of them, Kieran. So one is the use of antibiotics for a situation that is a sepsis mimic. So, you know, like sometimes you use antibiotics thinking that this patient has sepsis and basically there's something else going on. So likely the patient is not going to improve because you're not treating the mimic, like let's say a trauma or a pancreatitis or something else, a heart failure. The other pitfall is sometimes not knowing what is the susceptibility of the infections in your center. So you work in a center, in a hospital, in a region in the world in which you have sometimes a multi-resistant bacteria or other types of bacteria. So knowing what is the ecology, knowing what kind of bacteria live in your hospital, in your region, is really critical, because if you're reusing the wrong antibiotic, like the patient will not survive as well. So using not only timely, but the appropriate antibiotics. And the third pitfall that's really, really important, Kieran, is not treating the source, not clearing the source. What I mean about source of infection, antibiotics will definitely go ahead and kill the bacteria. But if the bacteria is located in a place where the access of antibiotics are limited, let's say a abscess in the belly, let's say you have an abdominal abscess, you have an empyema, you know, a fluid located between the lungs and the chest wall, or you have what you call, you know, a situation where it's very hard for antibiotics to penetrate in that area. Specifically, you see that with abscess and surgical complications. So you have to actually, let's say, if you have an abscess, the antibiotics will help to curtail the infection. But if you don't drain the abscess, could be a skin abscess, could be abdominal abscess, could be anything. If something does not get cleared in order to allow the antibiotics to penetrate in that area, it's going to be much harder to eliminate the sepsis and potentially even not eliminate the sepsis because the bugs will be sealed off in certain locations of the body. So source control is really, really critical, Kieran, because in combination with antibiotics, you can eliminate the sepsis. If you give antibiotics without source control, it's going to be much harder and potentially even more difficult to eliminate the focus of the sepsis.
Thanks, Andre. This is great. It's such a big area. So I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions, and I want to keep your answers really short, if you can, for the next bit. When you say we want to give antibiotics quickly, how quickly? Minutes? Hours?
Great question, Kieran. So the quick answer is you want to give the antibiotics in the next hour if somebody is in septic shock, and you want to give antibiotics within the next 3 hours if somebody's in sepsis without shock. That's kind of the general recommendation. 1 hour if in shock and sepsis, and 3 hours if the patient's not in shock but has sepsis. That would be really ideal. It would be feasible, optimal, and definitely very efficacious.
Okay, so another time-related question. How often should we monitor patients?
So you have somebody with sepsis. So this, if the patient has sepsis, the monitoring has to be, you're going to have a 24-hour care of this patient, you know, both, you know, by nurses and by physicians, because once sepsis is diagnosed, Kieran, the progression of the picture can be quite fast. And so organ dysfunction can develop fast. So you have to keep watching which organ dysfunction the patient already has at baseline. Is this organ dysfunction getting worse or not? Let's say if it's renal failure, liver failure, if it's hypotension, monitoring has to be literally by the minute. It has to be continuous until the patient is out of that kind of life-threatening situation. So it is quite intense and requires 24 hours hourly monitoring.
Excellent. Thank you. In terms of fluid needs, do you think we tend to underestimate or overestimate them typically?
It's a great question. I would say in most places on the planet, people tend to overestimate. There's too much fluid being given. I've seen a lot of patients that end up with pulmonary edema, respiratory failure because of excessive fluids. I've seen that many, many times throughout all my career, and this is well described in many, many cohorts and research papers as well. So I think that we are learning to be a little more cautious today. A lot of patients already come with either heart dysfunction or some other organ dysfunction that if you're too excessive with the fluids, you may end up causing more organ dysfunction than less. So it is very important, but I think it has to be a balance between a cautious approach of fluids and also a balanced combination with the use of vasopressors as well.
Great, thank you. What about nutrition support? When should you start thinking about nutrition support?
From the moment you diagnose sepsis, nutrition support becomes an important question. So ideally, remember, Kieran, that our microbiome, the bugs that we have in our bowel, are critical for everything that happens in our lives, both when we're in a healthy state and when we're in the sick state. And keeping our bowel bugs, our microbiome healthy is absolutely essential in this kind of situations where our body is struggling, like in sepsis. So the way that I approach, in a way that, in generally most of guidelines approach, is that as soon as possible that you can have a enteral feeding or something that can keep the patient well fed, it is really, really important. There's old times when I was in the beginning of my training many years ago, there was a wrong belief that you should give a rest to the bowel, you shouldn't feed the patient for a few days until you take care of the infection. It was totally wrong. Nowadays, we know that actually the early you start feeding the patient, the more benefits the patient get because you keep the patient in a healthy status. So this is really, really important. Thanks for this question, Kieran.
Thank you. And I read a lot about sepsis bundles. Can you tell us about what a sepsis bundle is, what the kind of the principle of it is?
So the principles of the bundles is really to kind of provide a more algorithmic, like, a more like a universal approach to sepsis. So, bundle of antibiotics, bundle of fluids, bundle of vasopressors, bundle of respiratory support. So I think it is a valid approach to understand, the each one of these needs that the patient have with sepsis. But I think that sometimes what concerns me with the bundles that we get a little too rigid about having to follow, bundle by bundle. And sometimes some patients are going to require, some specific bundles that other patients will not require. So I think, we as clinicians at the bedside, we have to be very cautious about having this kind of prescriptive approach, because that really sometimes can lead to situations that can be more harmful than good. And so our job is to, take these recommendations, these bundles with caution and try to individualize what are the needs of our patients.
Thanks, Andre. Sorry, I know I'm asking you tougher and tougher questions. The next one is even tougher. What about comorbidities amongst older people or sometimes middle-aged people? How can they complicate your management?
They can complicate very much, Kieran. So with diabetes, hypertension, some other immunocompromised situations like patients taking immunosuppressive drugs for other conditions. All these things can make the treatment of sepsis more challenging. So the reason why this is important, I appreciate your question, Kieran, is because there's no room to leave comorbidities out of control in this situation. So, and we saw that during the COVID pandemic as well. So the better controlled are your comorbidities before developed infection, the better outcomes you have from sepsis. The better controlled are your comorbidities when you're diagnosed with sepsis while you have sepsis, the better are the outcomes of sepsis. So the bottom line is either before developing sepsis or while developing sepsis, if you have a aggressive way to really control all comorbidities, your outcomes, your patient's outcomes will be better.
Excellent. Great. Thank you. Last question or two. What other common questions do you get asked about sepsis? What have we missed, if anything?
So many questions, no kidding, but I think that the biggest questions I have mostly come from especially trainees and junior physicians that are just starting, to practice, they have fears to miss the diagnosis, they have fears to not treat somebody who needs to be treated. So there is a little bit of a overcompensation here where without the experience, people tend to over-treat these patients, giving more antibiotics that they need or give antibiotics when they don't need. We see that especially in that kind of a training curve. And once you start to get a little more experience, you start to realize what really the patient needs. So I see these questions a lot. And I think that it's something that, I think it's part of our educational process, try to refine our educational process to making sure that the junior docs, the junior nurses learn this as early as possible to minimize mistakes in over or underexposure of treatments like antibiotics. Because as you know, if we over-treat patients that do not need antibiotics, so we end up not only giving more side effects that can be dangerous to our patient, but also we may end up with more resistant bugs that can make the use of antibiotics even more complicated, in the future.
Fantastic. Thank you. Last question, Andre. What do you hate being asked about sepsis. What question when you hear it, you think, oh my God, I can't believe he's asked me that question. It's really hard to answer. Tell us, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I would say what I hate to be asked is when, in my mind, it's very clear that the patient has sepsis and somebody either does not know the patient very well or is just getting involved with the situation, come to me and say, Dr. Khalil, do you really think the patient has sepsis? that's like, okay, it's very obvious the patient has sepsis. You know, there's so much, you know, it's so much data right there at the bedside to see. That really upsets me because, you know, it's something that is right in my face. So, you know, I think my biggest job is always, you know, try to be as education as possible. When people really don't realize what's happening, it's because the person really needs more education, needs more understanding. And that's our biggest job, is to really pass that teaching, pass that experience to everyone else that needs, because the missing diagnosis is what leads to a much worse outcomes and even worse mortality.
Okay. Thank you very much, Andre. And thanks to you all for listening. We hope that this has been helpful, and we hope you'll be able to put what you've learned into action to better diagnose and manage affected patients. If you want to find out more, click the link in the podcast to sign into BMJ Best Practice and have a look at the content on this and other relevant diseases. Thank you once again.